thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 34 for the 25th of November, 2008. Extra, extra. I'm Dan Cohen. Oh, I don't know how it's happened again, but Tom and Mills were back a little bit later than we had hoped. Gone 3 more weeks without getting in a podcast. Boy, it's been a busy fall. Of course, I'm talking to the regulars on the podcast here at Digital Campus headquarters at the Center for History and New Media. I'm Dan Cohen at dancohen.org, and I'm here with Tom Scheinfeld of foundhistory.org. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dan. How's it going?
Good. And Mills Kelly of edwire.org. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, so, we need to get our schedules more synchronized here at the Digital Campus headquarters so we can get a little bit more regular. Speaking of being regular, we're going to go a little irregular today and not have a featured story simply because we have so much news to go over from the month of November 2008. Wanted to kick right in with a story that's sort of a follow-up to the last podcast, Digital Campus 33, on the Google Book Search settlement. It seems like one of the blowbacks from this is Harvard says a kind of no thanks to joining the settlement simply because they're just not excited about some of the details, particularly in the way that the settlement with Google Book Search and the authors and publishers handles in copyright books. And they've said now that they're just not going to allow Google to scan their in copyright holdings from Widener Library and other libraries on campus. Thoughts about this? It seems like the only Google partner to react in this way. Tom Mills, what was your reaction to this and indeed the larger reaction to the settlement since we did our podcast?
Well, I think it's interesting that it's the only kind of blowback that we've heard. But I also wonder if it's not possible that it's because it's Harvard and that they don't have something else up their sleeve and the resources to do something else. I mean, one of the things it looks like they were concerned about were about limitations being placed on access of those in copyright books, and I wonder if they are planning to go a different direction. We've often said on this podcast that these universities, especially really wealthy universities like Harvard, could do some of this work on their own and don't really need to be outsourcing the work and the control of the work to a company like Google, that they could, if they wanted to, invest their own resources to do something perhaps more open, more friendly to researchers, and more thoughtful of a researcher's needs rather than of commercial needs. And so I wonder if it's possible that they're doing something thinking something else. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see on that.
Yeah, I mean, they did pull the Harvard Business Review from ProQuest not so long ago. And I think for similar reasons, they sort of argued that they wanted better control over the openness and access to it. In this sense, it's sort of in that vein. Mills, what were your thoughts about Harvard's response and just the general response of the academic community over the last few weeks of this settlement?
Well, I was actually at a conference this past week, and one of the sessions I was on was a library and archivist panel, and this issue actually came up, not about Harvard per se, but about the openness and access of some of these materials. And somebody said in the audience, and so I'm paraphrasing now what she said, but that this settlement made it clear that the Google Books initiative is a commercial initiative, not an access and openness initiative, and that was kind of dispiriting to her. And I think that's could be at the root of this, as Tom said, is that with the terms of the settlement being what they are, it's pretty clear that this is this is more of a commercial thing than it is an access and availability project now. And, you know, libraries are about access and availability of information, not about making money. And Harvard is in the enviable position of not having to worry about making money. And so, you know,
except that they just lost $10 billion on their endowments.
Well, yeah.
Well, $10 billion here, $10 billion there.
Yeah,
right. they can suck it up. So, right. So I think that's probably at the root of the whole thing is that the terms of the settlement really make it clear that it's a commercial settlement and a commercial project.
Right. I mean, you know, as part of that commercial aspect, I think what people started realizing a week or two afterwards is that some of those commercial details really aren't spelled out. For instance, the pricing structure, which I believe we did discuss on Digital Campus 33, I mean, it's just not specified what the actual pricing structure would be for libraries, for instance, to subscribe to the entire 7 million book collection. That's not spelled out. And I mean, in the same way that it's not clear to me yet what the researchers, the quote-unquote researchers' interface or access to the entire corpus would look like. So I think we need to see what those details are going to look like before, you know, we have a full sense of the settlement itself. Well, another big digitization project that launched and crashed was Europe's sort of answer to Google Books, I guess, if we can call it that. It's got a much wider range of content than Google Books. Indeed, it is in the entirety of European cultural heritage that's supposed to go online at europeana.eu. That's europeana.eu. Launched this past week with 2 million objects, half of which were from France. But unfortunately, it got 10 million hits an hour on the first day, November 20th, and proceeded to crash. Did either of you get a chance to look at this?
Unfortunately, no. It was down by the time that I logged on. So I wasn't able to see it. It's sort of unclear when it's going to be back. They have a kind of a splash page up with a YouTube video, kind of a demoing the project. But it's down for the foreseeable future, I think. And so we're going to have to wait and see on this one too, I guess.
And what I don't understand is how can a project be down for the foreseeable future? I can understand if they get overwhelmed by traffic and so they have to add server capacity or something like that. But I mean, could their software really have been so unrobust that it just can't work and then they launched it with something that wouldn't work? Or is it that there's some sort of a copyright issue that's come up or, you know, some kind of a legal question which they're masking by just keeping the site down and saying, oh, we were just too popular?
Yeah, I mean, my sense is this was just basically what we would call here at the center a dev site. You know, it's just a sort of test site that they had, you know, probably sitting on one server, you know, that wasn't optimized for loads or anything like that. And the URL got out and it just took it down. I mean, they don't have a Google-like infrastructure behind this is my sense. It is really weird that they say we're doing our best to reopen it in a more robust version. But my sense is that they've got to put a real technical infrastructure on this rather than just, a single server, single point of access on it.
But I mean, it was a planned launch. I mean, there had been some talk about it at least a few weeks prior to it. I know I was talking to some European colleagues and they were eagerly awaiting the launch of it. And so you know, I think but it is weird. It is weird that they wouldn't, especially if it's a European. Well, maybe that's it. It's a European Union project. But it seems like they're somewhere in the European Union. They have servers that are robust enough to carry this kind of load. So yeah, kind of weird.
But I think the encouraging piece of news is that 10 million people went to a website devoted to culture. And so that's, you know, I like that part of it, that they crashed because so many people were interested in history.
Yeah, the other thing I've heard about this is, and Dan, you mentioned this, is that half of the materials are from France. And that's kind of an interesting, seems like a France-led project, and I wonder how long before other European Union nations jump on board, or whether they're not going to. And it'll be interesting to see how that aspect of it turns out, the Europeanness of it, or whether it's becomes more of a project of a few European countries, and yeah. The other European countries do decide to go their own way.
I think that's a great point. It also just, I think, raises a general problem with these mass digitization projects that we haven't really talked a lot about on this podcast. Of all these projects end up with questions, these big projects end up with questions about cultural imperialism, the weightedness of them. I mean, Google ran into this early on where most of the stuff they were digitizing was, you know, English language materials, and they've since diversified. They added libraries across Europe to their scanning project. But, you know, it's not a technical issue, but it's a kind of social issue that all of these projects confront in terms of how they're weighted. And in this case, they ended up launching with 50% French material. And I think that caught a lot of people off guard. And certainly in the press coverage, you saw, you know, the British reaction, for instance. And I think everyone sort of tried to poo-poo it. But you do see these kind of underlying concerns about, well, will this be dominated by, you know, certain countries who've dominated European history?
Yeah, I also think that there's an institutional imperialism at work in some of this too. And I know that, at least speaking to some colleagues over there, that there's some concern that this model of centralizing these resources, even from individual institutions, never mind on a national level, is overreaching, and that there might be another model which is more distributed, which allows for centralized discoverability of resources, but localized control of those resources rather than dumping them all into a single European-wide database. So this, it does raise right. a lot of interesting issues. It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other model would be something like OAIster, or sometimes pronounced Oyster, OAIster.org, I believe. Which is, you know, a sort of federated collection that allows you to do search across multiple cultural heritage organizations, and they just use a standard format to centralize the metadata about those objects. But then you're spun out to the particular institution that houses that digitized object. I'm kind of surprised in this case that they didn't do something like that. And actually, in the case of something that's really just a federated search across these institutions, you don't have these load problems that you'd have with a centralized site.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, I actually assumed until I ran the demo from the website that's what it was, because I forgot that I was dealing with the EU, and so therefore they have to make everything big and bureaucratic. But I'm a devoted user of kayak.com for finding airline tickets, and that's just federated search of every possible place where you could buy an airline ticket, and it's so much more efficient. And so I assumed that's how this was working until I ran the demo, and I have to say I was kind of surprised that they're trying to create yet another big database that's going to be a hairball to live with.
Right, right. Do we even know where this is actually housed? And where's the
doesn't immediately.
No, it doesn't say, but I would have to guess France.
Right. Bibliothèque Nationale. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, we'll have to follow this when it's back up. We will link from the digitalcampus.tv site to, they do have some screenshots that you can see. It is strange that they still do not have a date up on their site as of this taping on November 25th, 2008, saying when they'll be back up. Well, I guess we'll have to revisit it. And speaking of revisiting, we'll revisit a story that we have tackled many times here on the podcast.
Or avoided tackling.
Avoided tackling. And I guess this begins a new segment on the Digital Campus podcast, which I guess we'll call the I Told You So segment. What do you think, Tom and Mills? Okay. I Told You So. We've earned it, I think, being on the air for a year and a half. Disparaging virtual worlds, and I guess the math PhDs at Google decided they'd pretty much had enough with virtual worlds as well, killing off a project we actually discussed in a news roundup some months ago, Google Lively, which was a pretty effective sort of Second Life that Google had done. It was a little bit different than Second Life in that you could attach it to websites, so there could be a Lively chat room that you could attach to websites, and it would actually run from the browser. They've just decided to shut it down. I mean, unceremoniously. We told you so. What do you think, Mills? You've been particularly active on this front.
I hate to say it, but I told you so. I've been a big skeptic for a very long time, and I think that, or the sort of about the long term viability of these kinds of projects, and one of the reasons is that, you know, for all of their money and for all of their expertise, Google is still way behind the curve compared to what the creators of video games are doing. I mean, if you just look at the visuals and the capabilities of things like Lively or Second Life, it's nowhere near what just kind of the average run-of-the-mill video game production company is creating. And because that's their core business model, and so their graphics are so much more robust, their storylines are better, they have these websites where you don't have a storyline, you create your own, and their communities are vast compared to the communities created by Second Life or Lively or any of these other attempts to cash in on that. And I just don't think that, you know, it's so far away from Google's kind of core business that I can't imagine that they were ever devoting too many resources to it. And, you know, we're already seeing lots of evidence that Second Life is beginning to erode, or the membership of Second Life is really beginning to erode. So I think that they're kind of next out the door, or maybe, you know, two or three intervening virtual worlds first. But I think Second Life is pretty time limited at this point.
Well, I think there's two issues here. You know, the first issue is like whether virtual worlds are a useful thing for teaching and learning and research and scholarship. And I think I haven't spent enough time in those virtual worlds, using those virtual worlds, to really have a good opinion on that. There's a second question, though, which is, should we be betting on these kinds of closed, walled garden commercial properties for experimenting with these virtual worlds? And that's been a lot of my problem with Second Life, is that, you know, at some point Second Life could just flat go out of business, and, you know, the grant money that's been dedicated to building various things in Second Life will just be gone. And so that's really where I have a problem. And here we see that Google just basically said, and they say, quote, it's not going to pay off.
Right.
So the commercial imperative is to just close the thing down. And that's right. It's not responsible for we as, you know, state-funded, largely state-funded scholars to be devoting those state resources to these commercial properties that can shut down at the drop of a hat.
Well, I'm actually speaking from personal experience with that, because in the last collapse of the dot-com industry, assuming there'll be another one someday, in the last collapse, I was using what the heck was the name of this company? It was the Digital Learning Group's online textbook. They were the first ones to try to create some kind of a hybrid website textbook thing, and they pestered me for, I don't know, 2 years to try their product in one of my classes. So I finally agreed, and I'm so mad that I finally knuckled under to their encouragements. And because halfway through the semester, I mean, this was my textbook for my Western Civ class, and halfway through the semester, I get an email at like 10 o'clock at night on a Tuesday saying, dear subscriber, user, or whatever I was, we're sorry to inform you that the Digital Learning Group has burned up all of its cash and we're shutting our servers down at midnight. Thanks for your interest in our product. And that was it. They were just gone. It was just like they had exploded and evaporated into the ether. And so my class was just nowhere. I had organized a whole class around this product, and it was gone. And so now was I going to say to my students, okay, now you have to go buy another textbook? I don't think so. I couldn't have been angrier.
Yeah, well, I can imagine a lot of Lively users are going to be pretty angry. I mean, on the official Google blog post on this, they say, I mean, this is just hilarious. The last line of the post says, well, we'd encourage all Lively users to capture all of your hard work by taking videos and screenshots of what you've built. I mean, that's the best they can do because, you know, the environment is gone. They can't do anything better than actually just taking videos and screenshots. So thank you for doing all of your work in Lively. It's gone now. Take some photos before you leave.
And, well, and the concern is, and as Mill says, with the diminishing usership of Second Life, that they're going to go the same way. And they certainly have less money to burn than Google does. And we saw this week that, right, that Reuters had a news desk in Second Life, and they've now taken that down. So
yeah, there was a great Eric Reuters, who was a reporter who, it's not his real name, I believe his real name was Eric Krangel. He was a Reuters employee who manned the Reuters desk in Second Life. And he wrote an interesting article for Silicon Alley Insider in which he sort of talked about why they were closing down and just gave his insider's perspective. And, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, I'll just quote part of this, but he says, "It's hard to say what, if anything, Linden Lab is the creator of Second Life, can do to make Second Life appeal to a general audience. The very things that most appeal to Second Life's hardcore enthusiasts are either boring or creepy for most people." Spending So, yeah, I mean, you know, it just seems like it's a niche product and maybe something that is not made for preservation or for accessibility to the most you know, most people in academia or libraries and museums.
Not unless we want to be boring or creepy.
I'd say the Second Life buzz in higher ed is probably wearing off pretty fast, and so those institutions that have invested in a Second Life presence might want to consider not spending any more money on that.
Right, right. Well, and I just think the general complaint that Eric Reuters is saying is also, you know, maybe just the whole idea of virtual worlds just doesn't work for a lot of people. I mean, he makes some good points in this article about, you know, it's a very steep learning curve for new users to, you know, figure out how to navigate around as opposed to something like a web page. You know, there's interactions are really bizarre with other people and the content issue. I mean, there's a lot of like creepy, weird stuff. So I know there are open source alternatives, but I just think the idea hasn't been sold to the vast majority of users.
Yeah, and I think that what virtual worlds don't have, or the problem that they have is that they're virtual, that they're sort of apart from the normal, the real world. And I actually just listened to a podcast where Jason Calacanis, an internet entrepreneur, was saying that like the things that have made it in the last few years on the internet are the web properties that connect your online world with your real life. Things like Facebook, things like Upcoming and properties like that. And I think that's the disconnect that it is. It's this completely isolated, walled world that doesn't really bear much resemblance, for all the talk of virtuality, like resemblance to the real world and the kinds of interactions and the kinds of things you do in the real world.
Especially if people like Dan are wandering around as a squirrel.
Yeah. I had my brief squirrel phase. I think it lasted about 2 hours. That's my Second Life experience. It was not that enjoyable. I prefer being a human. Well, another story from our news desk, speaking of real interactions that enhance what real people want to do, email. I mean, it's certainly a proven technology, unlike virtual worlds on campus. And, you know, the story on email that caught our eye was from the Chronicle of Higher Ed's Wired Campus blog, talking about Boston College is now going to stop offering new students email accounts. I guess this has been something that's been coming all year in 2008, hasn't it? I mean, we've talked about the outsourcing of email and how students have just, you know, they come to, certainly to George Mason with an email address already. I'm surprised this hasn't happened more often, right?
Yeah. And this is really even one step further. This is more than just outsourcing the email services to Google or Microsoft Live or whatever it is. This is basically saying we're not offering email. All they're really going to provide at BC is a forwarding address. So you'll come with your Yahoo email or your Gmail or whatever you have, and they'll set up some kind of email forwarding, so you could have a BC. I believe you'll still be able to have a BC email address, BC or bostoncollege.edu email address. But but they're not actually going to be providing any services or even paying to outsource any services. And I think, you know, it makes a lot of sense. It's not like I can't imagine there's a single college freshman on the George Mason campus who didn't arrive already with at least one, probably more email accounts.
Yeah, probably more. I mean, their Facebook contact info as well.
Yeah. So it really kind of doesn't make sense for us to be providing these students with email addresses any more than it providing them with uniforms or providing them with telephone, cell phones or anything. They come with those materials. So,
yeah, I mean, and in fact, many of my students are very resistant to using their George Mason University email address because they've already built an identity around their existing Google Gmail address or Yahoo address or whatever it is. And so I constantly have to go to Facebook and send my students a message saying your George Mason University email account is over quota. And it's because they never check that account.
Right. I mean, I've told my students to just use their GMU email address as an alias. So, you know, I teach them how to just do effectively what BC is asking. And they just set it up to forward all their email to Gmail or Hotmail or Yahoo Mail or some other, whatever source they're using. And so once you do that, then I can, you know, email the entire class to their Mason email addresses, but you know, it ends up in whatever correct silo they're actually using. I mean, it seems to me like these email addresses are just becoming like alumni email addresses. They're really a name only. Sorry,
yeah,
Tom. Go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, no. The only possible problem I can see with this is like if having that email account and that oftentimes I think that they end up reserving just for school communications. I mean, so they don't use it for anything else but communicating with their professors. If somehow now the email that we send to our students will get lost in the vast inbox that they maintain with all the other, you know, personal communications and junk and everything else that they and, you know, Amazon receipts and other things that they have in those accounts that somehow will get drowned out by all the noise. But I think we're probably being drowned out anyway. So,
well, let's see if this is makes it to our year-end roundup for top 10 trends to watch for 2009. But it seems like it's heading up with a bullet on the charts in terms of the way that colleges are handling email. Well, a lot of us use Gmail, and another Google-related story, or sort of tangentially related to Google, is seems like Google's going to get a couple of competitors in terms of their search that comes out of academia. A couple of announcements. One of them is the beta launch of RefSeek, which is at refseek.com. You can check it out. It looks a lot like Google, but it's supposedly a quote-unquote academic search engine. Basically what it does is it just strips out results that aren't related to science, research, or academia. So it does things like standard web search, but just, you know, pulls out the .com stuff and highlights things like web pages and encyclopedia articles, journal articles from EDU and org domains. Although, interestingly, it also throws in Wikipedia as well. And that's one thing that launched. And then we heard about a sort of planning grant. I think it's a $100,000 planning grant from the MacArthur Foundation to fund the planning phase of the Reference Extract project, which will be another search engine, this time created by librarians and other reference and information managers. Basically set up some infrastructure so that they'll have a Google-like interface. I guess it's at referenceextract.org. I should check the URL on that. Seems like it's not actually launched yet. Let's see. Actually, they've got a stub site up at, yes, at referenceextract.org. And right now they're just, I think, figuring out how thousands of librarians, indeed a coalition of, it says, over 1,400 libraries worldwide and their staff, we'll be able to create a kind of large-scale service that does a better job at finding high-quality content on the web. What do you think of these two projects, Reference Extract and RefSeek.com, and their chances of competing with something like Google for the attention of students and also the effectiveness of these potential projects.
Well, I haven't had a chance to look very much at the second one, but RefSeq, I have mixed feelings, I guess I would say. On the one hand, it'd be nice to have search results that match more closely what I'm looking for when I'm doing research online. At the same time, I'm a little concerned that I think one of the best things that's come out of digital humanities and the rise of the web and academic computing and technology on campuses is that it has put us back in touch with the wider culture, that we are now in many ways much more closely tied to the rest of what's going on in the commercial world, what's going on in the cultural sphere, in the public sphere. And I worry a little bit about walling ourselves off and saying, well, this is where the academic results go and this is where everything else goes. What would be really worrisome is if Google decided or someone else decided, well, we don't really need all of these academic resources in our search results, because what people really want are, they want links to shopping sites. And there became kind of a division, the old division between the academic sphere and the rest, or we ended up again in kind of an ivory tower. I think that one of the best things about technology on campus and with libraries and museums going online is that it's put us back in touch with that other world, that it's torn down the ivory tower to some extent, and this seems to seek to build it back up. I see the benefits of having some streamlined search results and having a more researcher friendly portal, but I do worry about the kind of larger message and the larger implications of this.
While Tom, you were talking, I just did a quick narcissistic search in RefWorks at searching myself, and
RefSeq or RefWorks?
RefSeq, yeah. And I don't think it actually, the results are as good. And in terms of usability, the first thing that comes up is my website at CHNM in both Google and RefSeq. But then in Google, the second thing that comes up is my blog, which for sure is probably the most trafficked thing on me. And in RefSeq, that's all the way on the second page. And the RefSeq results, I can't figure out what the algorithm is that's producing them yet. So I think they still have some tweaking to do also. But I agree with you. It does worry me a little bit that there's going to be sort of a place where serious searching goes on and a place where commercial searching goes on or something like that.
And in fact, your blog, Mills, is like the thing that connects you with that broader audience, with practitioners in the museum, with high school teachers, with students, with ordinary ordinary history enthusiasts. So to have that on the second page is undermining what you're really seeking to do with your blog.
Exactly.
I think the problem with these projects, and I think Reference Extract, I'm sure they're going to do a good job planning this, and I think one of the things they're going to find, so if anyone from Reference Extract is listening, I can tell you, because here at the center, we actually thought about doing something like this for history-related sites very early on, possibly using the Google Search API, but it was even before the Google Search API, we were trying to think about how you create a highly vetted database, which after all, we do that for a lot of our projects like History Matters, where we vet very high quality historical resources and put them up in a database. There's a number of problems that you run into. Scaling is very difficult. And as the web continues to grow exponentially, just figuring out inclusion, exclusion, those sorts of questions become really thorny. There's also an updating problem and a kind of freshness problem that Google has really solved, where they include new sites much faster than any project that, even if it has, let's say, thousands of librarians attached to it, they're not going to find new sites very quickly. Whereas, for instance, Google has a whole search architecture just related to blogs, and so they can get new URLs out of that really quickly and put it in their main search. So there's that issue as well. And I also think Google is going to change and respond to, they deal with dozens of variables for quality, some of which, some of them we don't even know, but it includes things like user experience. So, you know, they're keeping track of what people are clicking on for an assessment of, you know, did people find the first three results to be useful for what they searched for. So there's all kinds of variables that, that people are using at Googleplex to come up with high quality search that any new project is going to lack. And I kind of worry about that. You know, obviously there's also the, just the attention problem. How do you get people to use a new site? How do you, you know, force the student to go over to Reference Extract? There's a kind of eyeball question here as well. So it's tricky. I mean, I'd love to see some experiments on this end, but I just think, you know, Google does do a lot of things well. And I think the intermingling of commercial and non-commercial domains is important in, you know, increasingly. You know, there could be, for instance, a good blog post at blogger.com from a professor, and that would be excluded, for instance, from RefSeq. So these things are not so cut and dried, and I think there's just a lot of issues relating to creating academic search that when you start unpacking it, gets to be really tall order. And, you know, we should also say that while this is happening, you know, just this week, Google also, you know, they're a moving target, and they released something new that I think is pretty significant on their regular search pages. Now you can vote as effectively for or vote and or annotate search results to say, hey, this search result that came up is totally unrelated to what I was looking for, or hey, this site that comes up number 10 in your search should be number 1. And so they again are adding features to give them a feedback loop to say that a site is better than another site for a particular topic. So again, I'm just worry that it's just too hard to get all these variables right and to get the technical infrastructure in place to handle all of that. Well, we might have forgotten about a featured story for this week, but we haven't forgotten about picks for the podcast, where we select things we saw online, new resources, tools that our audience might appreciate. Mills, can I start with you this week? What did you pick?
Sure. This is actually a follow-up to one I mentioned in one of the early podcasts, and it's when I talked about Bill Turkell up at the University of Western Ontario giving a presentation about place-based computing, and you could actually watch the presentation. Now, for a little while now, Bill's had a website on place-based computing for those who are interested in beginning to do that kind of work, either themselves as historians or in their courses. And so it's part of his place-based computing initiative at the University of Western Ontario. And what I really like about it is that there, I talk to an awful lot of teaching historians now who are really interested in using GPS data or GPS devices or trying to do some sort of mashup with Google Maps or that sort of thing. This website is a really clear how to get started kind of site. It shows you sort of step by step, these are the things you should think about first, and here's how you go about doing that, and here's what worked for us, and here's what didn't. So for anybody thinking about getting started with place-based computing, either in their own research or in their teaching, this is really sort of the place you got to start.
Great. Okay. Seems like I haven't actually had a chance to read that yet, so thanks, Mills. Tom, what do you have for us this time?
I've actually got two sites here. First one is called 40 Chapters, and the second one is called Quill Pill. And these are both Web 2.0 services to help you write your first novel. 40 Chapters is kind of a more fully featured service, which has it provides sort of a structured environment to help you start writing a novel if you've never written one before. I haven't written one, and I'm not actually writing one. I'm not using these, but I thought they were kind of cool, and I'd sort of, in fact, be interested to hear from the audience to see if anybody has tried them and if they what they think of them. I kind of like the idea, but I'm not a novelist myself, but I do kind of interested to see how these things work. So 40 Chapters has a kind of structured writing environment where it helps you, it kind of walks you through the process of establishing characters and acts and chapters and scenes and in your their novels rather than, and as they say, rather than sitting down and staring at a blank page. And then Quillpill is a kind of microblogging service where you can kind of Twitter your novel in 140 character in scenes or dialogue of 140 characters or less. So two different models for online services for writing, and I thought, you know, in the U.S. we've got the Thanksgiving holiday coming up. If people wanted to whip out a novel, the Great American Novel, over the course of the Thanksgiving weekend, maybe you could do it over Twitter.
Right, that's right. You could do it from your phone while you're eating.
Exactly.
Thanksgiving meal.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sounds great. I'd love to read what the end product of a 140
yeah,
character per.
Yeah, these are not like picks that I'm actually like really pushing hard. I'm more just kind of interested in the concept and would like to hear what people have to say about them.
Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, well, my pick for this episode of the podcast is something that just launched yesterday in its official 1.0 version. And here at the center, we know it can sometimes take years to get to a real 1.0 that everyone feels comfortable with. But it's a project I've been tracking for some time. I think I've made picks before on the podcast for people who want to learn programming and have really no background in programming. And I think this is a really good programming language and system to start with. And it's called Processing. It's just the word processing.org is where you'll find it. And yesterday, November 24th, 2008, they actually launched the 1.0 version of the software, which means it's really robust. It's ready to use in the classroom and elsewhere. And what it allows you to do is do really nice-looking visual pieces of artwork. You can graph with it. You can create all kinds of visualizations of data or digital scholarship with it really easily. And what I like about it, and I've told a number of people who sort of haven't had any programming experience, is that it teaches you some of the basic structures that will be effective as you move to other languages that look kind of similar. So for instance, doing comments in your code, which is something we really encourage here at the center, is done exactly the same way in Processing as it is in PHP or C++. And it's really easy to get started. And what I like about it is that you can very easily create something that looks nice quickly. And that's, I think, something that's important versus, let's say, a language where you're going to create some program from start to finish can sometimes take a while. What's nice about this is you can create a nice color background and put a blue square on it and start moving things around and responding to mouse inputs really right on the first day. So a nice project. I think it came out of the MIT Media Lab and some of the work that went on there. And so again, that's at processing.org. Mills, Tom, have you ever taken a look at Processing? I think someone at that camp, maybe Dan Chudnoff, showed off Processing earlier this year at our UnConference here at the center.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm not sure if it was Dan, but somebody at that camp was demoing it, and yeah, I have taken a look at it, and it is a good way for a novice to get started, and like you say, Dan, to get some sort of immediate feedback. One of the rewards of programming or the reward is when you spend some time on something and wow, it works. And you get that kind of reward very quickly with Processing. So it is a good way to keep somebody who has maybe in the past been frustrated by trying to learn a programming language or a scripting language. It's a good way to get into it and get some easy feedback and get you moving.
Great. All right. Well, that's, again, Processing 1.0 is now out at processing.org. Well, as Tom said, for our listeners in the United States, we wish you a happy Thanksgiving. And for our worldwide audience, we wish you a happy week and weekend. And hopefully we will be back in 2 weeks for another episode of Digital Campus.
We have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
not what your country can do for you.